My name is Mark Schwain, and I serve the village this summer as one of the summer teaching staff coordinators. And one of my privileges connected to that job is to moderate the forums, which we hold once or twice a week here at Bolton. Let me say just a word about forums generally, and then a word about tonight's topic. Generally, always, our ideal forum of Holden is one in which people come with questions focused around the one we set up for the topic and leave with a deeper sense of what's at stake in those questions. Maybe some suggestions as to how to go about answering them, or at least how to go about getting more clear about them. We don't think of these as debates so much as we do conversations, which may include, and often do include, some difference of opinion, which is fine at Holden. Community is often related directly to the extent to which conflict is productive and in which conflict can go on, so that's fine. But we basically hope to help each other out by our disagreements to get a clearer sense of what's true and important about the issues we set out. So we invite all of you to participate. We do have, as is our wont, some folks who are going to start us off. Tonight's topic is, should Christians say no to Nike? And I want to have it clear from the beginning that I'm very even-footed on this subject, so that you can trust me as a moderator to maintain a kind of neutrality. After our summer theme is Guide Our Feet, and never seem more appropriate than this evening. All kidding aside, though, you need to realize that though the topic is, should Christians say no to Nike, and we may spend a bit of time focusing on that specific question, and some of our folks here may do that as they start off. It's really a way of giving some focus to a much broader question, which I suggested at the podium in the announcements, and that is really what kinds of things should Christians, individually and collectively, say no to in today's world? It's been a question for Christians from the beginning of time when they shifted from being persecuted by the empire to being, in a sense, officially in charge of it, or officially in sympathy with it, as to what extent Christians can credibly remain Christians and be implicated in the economic, political, cultural practices of the nation, state in which they find themselves. So really, this particular question about Nike is really one part of a much broader issue about how Christians can go about discerning what kinds of things, practices, beliefs, and institutions in our globalized political culture seem deeply contrary to the gospel. Maybe one of those practices involves, as we said, the consumption of goods that are produced by multinational corporations that show little or no regard for basic human rights, and maybe Nike's one of those companies. But I've asked our four folks to address this issue briefly, just to set some further stuff out on the table, and then we invite all of you to share your stories, criticisms, comments, and thoughts about this matter. Just briefly, to my immediate right, and who will speak first, is Dorothee Zola, who's teaching with us. She comes from Hamburg and has thought lots about these issues, written a lot about theology and social justice issues. To her right is Mark Mathias, also known around the village as Sparky, a long-term staffer who's soon, sad to say, to leave us, but who for many months edited Good Courage and other Holden publications. Those publications contain a lot of interesting stories and information about issues that are concern of us tonight. And then to his right, Professor Chuck Schaefer, who teaches African history and is teaching in the village on the shape of Christianity in Africa and knows something about the impact of the industrialized world on countries that are less developed. And to his right, Professor Tom Kennedy, who's chair of the philosophy department at Valparaiso University and has written widely on various subjects in Christian ethics. I should say that they may or may not at least initially, be stating positions that are their own, and they may choose or not to say whether the positions they're setting out are their own. We hope to get among the four of them some balance on the subject so that we can all jump in at that point. So in any event, without further ado, let me turn to Professor Dorotea Zola. Should Christian say no to Nike?
I think, first of all, I would like to make a theological statement and say that from the very beginning, Christians said no to certain things. There is no yes without a no, I think, in all of our lives. And the yes to God's liberating deed, namely to getting us all out of Pharaoh's worship in the Exodus and out of our death into life, Christ's resurrection, this good deed frees us to say no, frees us from the idols, with, according to the Jewish and Christian tradition, we are surrounded. There is no life without those idols which are always around. And I think this is most clear now in our time of shift we have gone through. I personally believe that the next century has begun in 89 with the collapse of the Roman Empire, the Second World. And I think we have now very different things to think about. And when just to look for a moment back to the early church, to the early group of Christians, congregations, they stand in a critical position over against their own, some of the important rules of their own time. These rules were given by the Roman Empire. This was the ruling force. And one rule was that religion was free because it was private. It was a private affair to believe in this and that and hundreds of gods and goddesses, no problem. It was what they called religio licita, which was an allowed religion. But what was not free was not to believe in Caesar and his role, and you had to bring incense to Caesar. And if you did not do that, you would be persecuted, as Jews and Christians both were in for a long time before the shift you pointed to. And I think we have to remember that Christians are people who say no to some things in the world. And they cannot be friends of Jesus if they don't say no to certain things which happen in our world, like those violations of human rights and those new forms of slavery, as I see them, which we have now with the economic shift. We live in a world of new idols which demand obedience. I think any parent here knows this, how much obedience from the side of the parents is expected towards the dictatorship of transnational corporations and their Nikes or whatever it is. And the whole thing operates in a way that obedience is almost seen as a necessity. You can do without. Children, young people very often tell this their parents, I can't come, go to school without my Nikes or go to this Nike or whatever. So it's this necessity is part of the ideology under which we live. And so we have to think about what we can do. The golden calf of the free market is oriented towards profit-making without any regards for the needs of the losers in our world. It's a winner-oriented society in which we live. We have to follow their rules. And the slaves produce for the free market no any respect for environmental or social issues, which maybe a national state still has, we're just in the process, to have to give that up. This is multinational agreement on investments and AI, which is a terrible new constitution for economic life in our world. And I do believe that boycott plays a role, like in the last century strike, the working class strike, which was their main means of liberation. And a similar means of liberation is now given into the hands of consumers, not in the hands of workers. And we are skeptical about that. In the hands of consumers, as we all are, and specifically in those who do not believe in the golden calf.
Thank you. I think that with the word boycott and the suggestion that insofar as Nike can be shown to be producing its products through new forms of slavery, one ought to say no to them through a boycott. And turn now to Mark, who has thought and practiced boycott to some extent, to see what he has to say about the subject.
I would also start off with a theological statement, but as a layperson, and what I think is central to the gospel, and that's the words of Micah, the words of Luke, that say, what is required of us but to do justice and to love kindness, to preach good news to the poor? And I think that good news is not necessarily salvation or heaven at a later point, and it's not enduring life to reach that point, but it's that liberty is at hand. Today can be. If we answer that call that's extended to us by the gospel, and if we respond as people of faith to that call, to saying no to corporations like Nike, where the CEO is making dollar after dollar, and the workers of Nike in Indonesia, among other places, are making penny after penny. There's a distinct inequity, injustice there, that we as people of faith, as consumers, need to address. And I think that that happens any time that kind of a scenario occurs, whether it's Nike in Indonesia, whether it's Shell Oil in Nigeria, or earlier in South Africa during the apartheid days when Shell was firmly in support of the apartheid government. They're now in that same camp, the Nigeria government, supporting a military dictatorship, whether it's Unocal or its subsidiary Union 76 in Burma, and where the people of those situations, where the workers or the citizens of that country rise up and say, well, we're not going to take this anymore. This is not, it's not correct, it's not fair, it's not just, it's not what God longs for. That we as people in this wealthy place, I think, are required to stand with them in whatever way that we can. And if that means boycotting, not buying Nike, not pulling up to the Shell pump, not pulling up to the Union 76 pump, that's really a very small thing that we can do. And it's, I'd almost argue that it's so small, so minuscule, that it's embarrassing, really, that we do at least that. And so I think we're called to that. I think Jesus gives us the example of that in the temple, where he threw out the money changers. I think Nike and Shell and Union 76 are the money changers of our day. And that if we are to call ourselves Christian, then we need to look at that example that Jesus had of throwing out the folks that were oppressing and making a profit off of poor people, and making a profit through weighted scales and overpriced products in a situation that just got out of hand, so to speak. So I think we need to hear the gospel, listen to that, and respond as people of faith to unjust situations so that the reign of God might indeed come and be filled with justice.
Thank you, Mark.
How many of you have bought a pair of Nike running shoes?
Basketball shoes?
Basketball shoes. Any kind of sort of sports shoe, cross trainers, whatnot. Okay, well, this sort of exemplifies, I think, Nike's market share in the United States. I think it's somewhere in the 60-70% of the market share is dominated by Nike. Next is Reebok. I believe Adidas, New Balance, some of the others, the Puma maybe, they still exist. You can see I'm sort of thinking back in the 70s.
Thank you.
Have a market share that is just infinitely small in comparison to what Nike does or has. So what are we really trying to boycott? Are we trying to just boycott Nike and distribute a little bit of the largesse of the consumer to these other poor companies like Adidas? Or are we doing something else? And I think as Christians, what we really need to do is really think about what we are doing. Nike, yes, it does exploit workers in Malaysia, certainly Indonesia, that comes to the fore. In China, there's new evidence that some of the Nike's components are made in China. Now, we all know the Chinese laborers are very ill paid. And so I was swept up in this, and I boycotted Nike and bought a pair of New Balance, thinking that I was doing justice. Only to find out that these conglomerates are buying components from some of the same factories. And that my New Balance, well, who knows where they came from. But I'm sure that the New Balance people are not paying their workers any more than Nike are, or that the quite reasonable, cheap, athletic shoes that you can get at Walmart are probably made in the same kinds of factories there. So does one pay, say, $98 for a pair of Nike or $18 for a pair of whatever they are at Walmart, knowing full well that the components are made in the same factory? So I'm just trying to problematize this. Is it just to say Nike is the culprit, that Nike has to go and pay their workers more, when swooping in will be Adidas and New Balance and all the rest to buy those components at incredibly reduced prices and take them to the assembly plant somewhere else and then ship them to the United States at less cost? So it's a very, very complex thing, as all boycotts are, as Shell Oil is, as the boycott in South Africa are. So I think as Christians, what we really need to do is look intently and specifically at what we are hoping to do by boycotting a certain certain company or a certain product. And I think I better stop there.
Okay, so this is to complexify the issue. I hear you saying that one has to ask if one boycotts Nike what one will do instead, and whether doing something else is going to really make much of a difference, etc.
From one perspective, it seems to me that the personal perspective of stewardship, the question is fairly easy, or quite easy. Unlike Mark Schwain, I'm not a runner, a long-distance runner in marathons and other races. The excellence of my dog walking, my basketball, my occasional racquetball is such that I don't require Nike shoes or any other name brand equipment. I can get by on Walmart, socks, and whatever's on sale at Sportmart. The same is true for my family, I think, although it has to be admitted that my children face social pressures that I don't myself face and don't have to deal with, even as aggressive as the basketball play can be in the faculty of the university court. Typically, for most of us, then, I think, in terms of stewardship, it would be better stewardship for us to say no to Nike, to buy some other kind of shoes. But I take it that's not really our question tonight, that our question tonight is either on political or prophetic action. In either case, it seems to me, when we ask the question, should we say no to Nike, the question is, should the church say no to Nike? Should the church in Tacoma or Fargo or Valparaiso say no to Nike as a political statement? The primary norm for political action, I think, is efficiency or efficacy, being effective. Those actions which will not affect the goals in view, and in this case, I take it the goals in view are decent wages for Nike workers. Those actions which will not affect those goals are certainly not required of the church. Would a church saying no to Nike affect the desired change? I suspect it wouldn't. But there may be studies that show otherwise, that as a matter of fact, the church is saying no to Nike would bring about the change. I'm not sure. I suspect a more effective strategy would be to say yes to Nike, in fact, in terms of stock holding, in terms of seeking employment in Nike Corporation and Nike-related businesses and working for reform from within. Or perhaps the way to say no to Nike would not be by boycotting Nike products, but by public protest of those who endorse Nike. Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods at games and tournaments, and asking them to say no to Nike in a way that I think would, in all likelihood, be more effective. But in short, I think it's unlikely that the church is saying no to Nike would be warranted as a political action, as one that would bring about the desired change. But that leaves it open as a prophetic action, an action on the part of the church to testify publicly, regardless of the effectiveness of the testimony, that a practice in question so devalues humans, the creation, or God, that we cannot be silent. Now, to say no prophetically is to recognize the church's calling to act as agents of God for justice and peace, and to be willing to suffer for the cause of God in our world. The question is, do the manufacturing practices of Nike warrant the response of a prophetic no? Well, it's not obvious to me that they do. Undoubtedly, it would be a good thing if Nike workers were to receive a better wage. And undoubtedly, Nike could afford to pay Michael Jordan less and pay its workers more. But are the workers coerced to work for Nike? Would these workers be better off without Nike? It may be the case that these workers themselves should organize and they should say no to Nike. It may be the case that the church in Malaysia or Indonesia or other relevant places should say no to Nike. But I think it unlikely that a church in Tacoma or Fargo or Valparaiso will find no nearer and greater injustice such that it might appropriately and confidently declare that this is their stance with God at this point and at this time.
Okay, thank you all. I think there's enough in that mix to get us started. Many different angles of vision on this complicated question, and the floor is yours. Should we say no to Nike? And should we say no to anything as Christians, and on what grounds? Surely they haven't said everything to be said. Yeah. Yes?
I had a friend in high school that did a report on some of the factories down there, and I just have a question if anyone has any statistics on this or actually no facts. That he told me that a lot of the workers that work in these factories in their own country, they are making enough money to survive, but with our aspect of it, we think they're making less, but with their currency, all that, does that make sense? Okay. That they're actually making enough money. But does anyone have any facts on that?
I don't have facts on that particular case, but I think that's what I was going to identify as another wrinkle to complexify it, in that a lot of what we might think of as just incredibly miserable, rotten, very low wages are in fact better than what they would have earned, in terms of some of the subsistence kinds of work they might have had otherwise. Now, I don't think that necessarily solves the question, but it makes it more complicated.
I can tell you that at least the recent article I read that looked at U.S.-owned factories in Mexico, and that workers in those factories were making less than the average wage of per capita for the Mexican population. So that there is a little bit of a myth that says, oh, well, at least you know, they're making something, which is, of course, a true statement, but at least in Mexico, folks working for Ford and Gap Jeans, et cetera, are making less than if they were not working at those factories.
So clearly this varies from situation to situation, and that your question and some of the responses suggest that whatever we do or refrain from doing, one needs to do one's homework. And the church ought to be about the business of conducting the kind of research that Karen and others have to find out the facts in these situations. Yes?
Just to mention that we have in Europe a campaign against clean clothing campaign, CCC, clean clothing campaign, which comes from the Netherlands and has spread out in Germany and other countries. And it talks about the textile workers, women, basically, who live under standards, especially in Latin America, which are beyond any understanding. It's 12 hours they have to work. They are allowed twice to go to the toilet. That means they cannot drink as much as they need. They have small bottles with them, which they then finish, and that's it. When a woman is pregnant, and they can't fire her immediately because of the laws, what in those countries still forbid these things, then they place her somewhere else where she has to stand 12 hours, and no pregnant woman will do that, so she leaves herself. There's one, in those women, and it's interesting in the context of the question of boycott, is this good or not? Because those women don't want the boycott. Mm-hmm. They want the protest. Mm-hmm. They want clarification. They want public perspectives that we know what we do and that we ask in our places where we buy clothing. Do we know from where this comes? Have you an idea of how the workers are dealt with? And to do this pretty publicly, when many people are around, and maybe we stand around, start this talk with this poor sailing woman who doesn't know anything, of course, and but start it and go through with that, to at least make us aware of what goes on, you know. And that is, I meant that with slavery. These slaves are happy to be slaves because there is no other way for them to survive. And things getting worse and worse. That's another point I want to make.
Should we think that this is a third world problem within the last 2 years in San Gabriel Valley, where Pasadena is in California? They discovered people enslaved doing textile work. And downtown Los Angeles is notorious for the sweatshops producing the cheap garments for all of us. So it doesn't. We don't have to look outside of ourselves to see enslavement in this kind of vicious circle.
Well, I ask the question: is it any different for our government to train one segment of society to make a deal with another country, as agriculture products, let's say, or anything, that they make a deal to trade because of, for what reason, and it throws an impact on someone else because of that. You know, and so I don't think it's us being aware, as far as I'm concerned, that there's inequities, if you will, and then to speak out to them, they could be, because they're against what we believe. It's more the way I think than it is, whether it's Nike or it's whoever it is. It's, when there's an inequity and we see it, we should be willing to stand up and say, I don't believe that's right. And put the pressure there and say, no, I don't like it. I would rather it be another way. And it doesn't have to be, you know, it can be right here in our own government, in our own state, in our own community, if you will.
This is to echo, I take it, a bit of a what Professor Kennedy said about the particular tactics by which one addresses matters of injustice. And you're favoring more of a direct approach, not simply a boycott, but confronting those who are treating others in such a way so that they're
unjust. Well, I'm saying just stand up for inequities, whether they're in the township you live in or in the community you live in or whatever it is, because that's where it starts. Or if you see a wrong being done, if you don't stop it there, it just multiplies. I mean, you've got to do what you can where you are.
Okay, good. Thank you. Yes, Bill.
I just want to expand a little bit on what Dorothy said. It seems to me it is a vocational issue for Christians to say no, but that no is so complex. I think Chris Chuck was saying, or maybe it was Professor Kennedy, just the way these multinationals create peer pressure for us and for our kids. And an example of where a no worked almost instantaneously for a large corporation was Calvin Klein, when they started using young children, teenagers, for their lingerie. And there was such an uproar that they stopped it. So it just seems to me that the no is so complex. And as Sharon was saying, the more we know about this, the more it impacts us and affects us. And how do we, on the local and the national level, protect ourselves? I mean, the fact that, Walt Disney owns the American Broadcasting Corporation and is impacting the third. We have a hamburger in the Radisson Hotel, and people flock to it. Dorothy is absolutely right. It's a vocational issue, and how do we say no, as this man was saying? The place where we live, in San Gabriel Valley, or it be in Indonesia or Malaysia.
May I say a few things? To your issue about wages, that's very, very complex, and maybe that's not really what the issue is with Nike. I don't know exactly the Nike case, but I do know a case in Ethiopia that existed in this. There was this French firm called Michel Kutz, and they had a big sugar plantation, and they were under some pressure to raise the wages of the laborers at the sugar plantation, which they did after pressure. Then it sort of came around that the wage earners were actually earning far more than other people within the town, and since they had all this superfluous money, the merchants in this town started raising prices, and who really suffered? It was those people, those inhabitants of this one region of the Awash, who weren't earning those kinds of wages, and they were very disgruntled and bittered by this whole effect, simply because this added capital into this sort of a finite, a concrete market system led sort of commodity prices to go up, and they couldn't afford them. So that's really complex. But I think what the main grievance with the Nike case is the sweatshop conditions, where child labor is employed, where people are required to work 12 hour or more, 12 hours a day or more, where they're given no benefits and all those kinds of conditions. And so what we're sort of doing, I think, in many of these boycotts is going back and reading Dickens about the conditions in England in the 19th century and saying, gee, there's parallels now. What did the labor movement do there, and what should we try to get people to do elsewhere? And I think, Tom, you're absolutely right. Maybe it is the Indonesian church, the Malay church, who should be taking a stand against it. But sometimes I think we can also lend a hand to
Yes, Karen.
Yeah, I want to pick up on Tom's criteria of effectiveness, and I just want to say something about the Malaysia, Indonesia, because I think we might be fooling ourselves about how possible it is for Christians really to protest it there, because I was with some Malaysian and Indonesian Lutherans at the same conference 6 months ago, and, you know, I mean, in Malaysia, you know, you're pretty much an outlaw if you're a Christian, much less being able to speak up or exercise any political power. But I think the effectiveness one, to me, the saying no, where it can be more effective is through groups like the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility, which many mainline denominations participate in, and where the filing of some shareholder resolutions has really made a difference in terms of some of the, for example, GA, General Electric practices down in the maquiladoras, and especially the large campaign they've had for some time of some global corporate ethics kind of code that they're really trying to get more and more companies to adopt. And I think if we're talking about effectiveness on a broader scale, you know, again, there can be lots of ways of trying to wiggle out of those codes, et cetera. But at least I think that's a forthright effort to say, yeah, let's get serious about this, and how could churches together put their collective power together to make a difference in terms of these practices, so that it isn't just a matter of saying, well, if I can't do it there, you know, then, you know, this company will do it here. Because I think, you know, we're dealing with a very slippery kind of thing here. It's going to slip from one place to the other if we do focus a boycott in one area. The other example I want to throw out on the table, and it's still part of the same refrain of how I think the church needs to be our counter to some of this. Some of you who are from Minnesota and Fargo know the name of Ann Canton and her activism around rural issues, and she one of her phrases that's really rung in my ears is, I count on the church to be the only space left in society to be my counter to what's happening in terms of the global economy. And an example of that, I sit on the Interfaith, National Board of the Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice, and we had, I was approached because they knew I was Lutheran on that board. And it's an example of a horrendous labor practice in this country where we needed the international church connection of our Lutheran brothers and sisters in Europe, where labor practices are much better. It was a Swedish-owned company, and I believe it was Tennessee, had a horrendous labor strike going on for some time. And they said, aha, we discovered, you know, they'd done their research, the people were working on how to counter this and help the workers. And we realized the CEO is sitting over there in Sweden, and we know the Swedish church has become very public in terms of how it's been speaking out in some of these global economic practices. You know, could you appeal to them to get them to, well, as it turned out, the labor minister in Sweden, before any of that came about, publicly embarrassed the CEO. Well, of course, he then quickly tried to sell out this subsidiary and get rid of it because it was becoming an embarrassment for him. And on the European scene, he was looking terrible. You know, but he was able to get away with those kinds of labor practices here in this country. So even though that didn't really come to fruition, it kind of, you know, some lights went on of, you know, what would it mean for us really to take seriously, you know, that we are a part of a worldwide communion and deal with these, you know, the kind of exploitation that's going on, and find effective ways to be in communication and supporting Christians, including in those places, Christians and others, including in those places where it's not possible for them to protest those practices.
Okay, anybody else have stories or accounts of how their individual churches or coalitions of churches have been able to act in concert to address some of these issues?
I'd like to say something to build on what Karen said and how frustrating it is. We promise not to stone me. I do own some stocks. therefore, I read these stockholder meeting things, and almost inevitably, it's a little group of nuns who are going in. I don't see the Lutheran Church, the Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church ever mentioned, which is something for us to take to heart. But these little group of nuns somewhere state their position. They've done their homework. And then I see all this business gobbledygook saying how you stockholders, in your own best interest, must vote them down. And I think so far, keeping track of this for about 2 years now, it's 100% that the board of directors say, no, it's not in our business interest, and wipe them out. But they persist, and if some of us can join them, maybe the best, all you're doing, you're hitting against the wall, but you're making a mark. And maybe that if enough of us hit against the wall and have the patience to do it, there may be some changes. But it's frustrating when you see the
thing. I think there will be a change if we do enough.
But I think Nike is a perfect example. If you're accurate in saying they have 67% of the market share, they're somewhat vulnerable, actually, at that point to consumer demands, and it takes away some of that slipperiness. You say, well, okay, everybody's using the same supplier, but if you say to Nike, we're not going to buy your product, we're going to cause trouble at your board meeting until you change the situation, because they're such a major player, when they change their practices, then everyone else is going to follow suit, and that becomes one strategy. And looking at a particular industry, say, okay, we can't go after everyone necessarily, but we can go after the leader of an industry. And if we can get them to change their habits and their business practices, then Puma, with its little tiny share, of course, again, they're buying from the same thing, from the same subcontractor. So they're gonna their practices will then be fair, because Nike's practices are fair as the leader of the industry. So that takes away some of that complexity if you can see a kind of clear strategy.
Well, you missed. Other comments on this issue of effectiveness and political action in concert? I want to get back to...
I would like to say a word about this in terms of what's more religion. I think this is a good question, of course, effectiveness, but success is not the name of God, said Martin Buber. It's a great phrase, I think, and one has to keep that in mind. And these nuns you are talking about, I know the Saint Franciscans stand in Frankfurt before the Deutsche Bank, one of these leading enterprises, and talk about forgive us as we forgive those who have debts with us. And do this again and again and again and again. And it has no sense, says any business person, for what do they do that? It's ridiculous. And Jesus is also ridiculous. Don't we know that?
You read my mind. I really wanted to get people to think about this distinction that Tom made between political and prophetic action, which is related to what Dorothea just said. And just see whether, first of all, everybody understands that and what that might mean. One of the favorite stories John Schramm, who was former director, used to tell, came out of the diary of John Woolman, who is a Quaker, 18th century, who tells a story about going up to a stagecoach, and the man before him is African-American, and the stagecoach won't sell him a ticket. So Woolman simply refuses to ride on the stagecoach and quietly walks the entire distance, I think it was 15 miles. Didn't change the stagecoach policy, didn't confront the stagecoach there, simply wouldn't participate in that particular mode of conveyance. An example of a kind of prophetic action, because it wasn't undertaken for the sake of effectiveness, but for the sake of being faithful. And does everybody kind of kind of grasp that that distinction between a prophetic and a political action. Not that it's always that clean, and not that the one might lead to the other, and not that disciplining ourselves to be prophetic might not lead us to be more political, but you can kind of feel the difference there, can't you, in those two things?
A phrase that I heard that captured that really well is that we're not called to be successful, but we are called to be faithful. And then another way of maybe is, for whom would we make this decision? We've talked about saying no to Nike for the sake of the workers. But what about for our own sakes? I mean, at what point do we contaminate ourselves, or at what point do we give ourselves away? And I'm sitting here thinking of sort of it's a personal example, but my children were little when the fruit roll-up craze started. And they started out with just very plain fruit roll-ups. And then they got all sorts of Garfield shapes and dinosaur shapes. And it just seemed like calculated covetousness, that it was calculated training of my children to want the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And at one point I said, absolutely not. No food in this house that comes in shapes. And, you know, that sort of sounds silly, but for me it was the moral formation of my children that was at stake at that point. I knew I was not going to change the fruit roll-up company, but I was teaching my children a lesson that you cannot just want the next one and the next one and the next one. So at some point, there's a personal stake in our own integrity that is a part of this question.
Very nice. Thank you for that. Others on this point? Yes, ma'am.
I've always felt that for some people, boycotting is like a Band-Aid. I've done it, I'm done. I mean, that's all I'm going to say.
And can you say one more thing about what you'd recommend instead or in addition?
Well, I think we have to take a little more, we have to be, first of all, armed with information. We have to know what it's all about and do our homework, have some, and then we have to know who's in control. Yeah, it's just so easy to not buy Shell and buy Union, you know? But we feel good about it, right? It can't be that simple. And it has to be a larger, we have to embrace it more fully.
I thought I saw a hand over here.
Can I respond to that?
Yes, you may.
We talked about boycotting Shell as a winter community here at Holden Village this past year. And one of my frustrations in that is one of the people that brought that issue to saying, let's boycott Shell. We buy Shell oil from the Shell distributor in Chelan. That was the main reason that issue came up. One of my frustrations, and what my frustration with your statement is that there's no alternative presented. With that, without an alternative, you're saying, well, we're just going to be on the side of the status quo. And that then becomes, I would say, unacceptable. That something, when you're confronted with a situation, such as what's happening in Nigeria with Shell, where they're practicing environmentally unethical scenarios, and they're calling in the military on people that oppose their business, they're peacefully opposing their business, and you say, well, we can't boycott, but we can't think of anything else. You know, then there's something wrong with that equation. You have to at least take an action, and to say it's too simple to boycott, I think often lets us off the hook, and I think that's often what happens when we say it's complex. Well, it's complex, what am I going to do? It's complex, I'm going to do nothing. We're called to action, and that's where it fits in with being faithful at the very least, and sort of wrap my comment up here going back to this. Several years ago I visited the grave of Mother Jones, who was a union organizer in this country back in the early part of the century. She's buried in a union cemetery, which sprang up when the churches wouldn't bury people in unions. And there was a gravestone next to her that said, I act not to change my enemy, but so that my enemy will not change me. And so that's why I boycott. I mean, it's going to this thing. You're right, it makes me feel good. It's not complete enough, but it keeps me, at the very least, from being changed. And when somebody comes along with a more complex strategy that will further that, I will readily join in that. But it becomes a unified strategy, hopefully, and that a boycott is a part of.
Thank you, that's good. I think that what you hear there is, yes, get the information, but don't be caught up in what we used to call in my era the paralysis of analysis. One can just say it's all complex, and that sometimes can become a kind of word for kind of maintaining the status quo. I think the challenge is maybe this isn't the best course, but then suggest another one. As Tom did at the beginning of his remarks, there are other ways to confront the powers that be. And in a given case, at a given time, boycott may not be the best, but then suggest something else. Very nice. Other comments?
I don't.
Yes, back here.
Yes, it's perhaps silly to say something like this, but it's been recognized that the issue isn't really Nike in itself, but I tend to be skeptical enough, I suppose, to say that if you looked at any major corporation, you're going to find things that would cause you to want to boycott that corporation. And in that sense, there's a futility that's perhaps being expressed with a boycott of a particular corporation. So the silly thing to say is, why instead of accepting and buying into what the consumer role that we have in corporations until we find out that there's something wrong? Why not the reverse and not buy into anything until we find that it's worthy of our interactions? And the reason it's probably silly to say that is because there really isn't a genuine alternative, it seems, offered by a community of believers that I'm aware of, at least. And that is, I can't go out on my own. I'm wearing Converse tennis shoes because I got them really cheap, and I'll wear Nike if I get them really cheap, because I don't know as though it matters that Nike's practices are bad, and probably Converse's are too, and I can't explore all of them. But I'm skeptical to think that I have to participate in what major corporations have to offer because I don't have a good alternative, usually. And perhaps I shouldn't be as skeptical as I am. There are some alternatives, I suppose, and the Amish come to mind as a community that probably less than most of us buy into and just participate in the economy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And would you say that kind of thing that you've just applied to athletic shoes, is it your kind of general sense of frustration extends to almost all corporations and almost every field of endeavor, that it's just very hard to make the kinds of distinctions you'd like to be able to make in practice?
Yeah, as a person that goes to work and raises a family and does, you know, is busy, obviously I can't investigate all of the businesses with which I do business. And I know that there's, we might say, evil. There's the wrong motives. I live in the same neighborhood, well, the same county as Phil Knight. And so I know about Knight, but I'm skeptical enough to think that that's only because the spotlight's on Phil at this moment.
Any word of response to that point? I mean, I think that touches a way a number of people sort of feel when their consciousness gets raised. It does, and a number of issues are brought to their attention, and they look further and just feel a little bit like Chuck announced at the beginning that, well, you might not buy Nike, but then where are you going to go? And you just feel kind of crushed, in a sense, by the all-pervasiveness of some of this. Has anybody got a good word or an encouraging word or some help for this kind of feeling, which I think many of us have?
Well, at the risk maybe of talking too much here for a little bit, this is my first philosophy, and that I will join a campaign, whether it's boycott or what have you, when somebody calls it. Okay, we can take Nike versus New Balance and say, absolutely correct, both equally
ingest, and any major corporation is probably going to be in that category of ingest, not paying a living wage, not being environmentally sound. But when a people, either it's the workers or an outside monitor, says, here's who we're raising up right now is the strategy. Let's not buy Nike. Let's picket in front of Nike. Let's picket in front of Union 76. Whatever. I will join that effort to lend myself to that and trust those people to do that research for me that I can't do, just as you say, because it becomes just too overwhelming. And then, again, hopefully, once you get Nike to change its practices, then New Balance has to sort of follow in line. Or then you move on to New Balance at that point. And again, it's this thing of, you're not necessarily going to be successful, but that's not our call as people of faith. Sure, that's a bonus. It's a very big bonus. But the benchmark is to be faithful. And that's how I find how to do that, to where I can join in solidarity with another movement.
And I'll just point out that there are fair trade organizations that you can find out on the web that are using the web as their main organizing tool, because they really have no other cost-effective way to. And, you know, once again, you've got to trust them. You're not going to run around and investigate every little co-op that they're buying their produce, their items from. But, you know, I hide the boxes, so do me just fine. There are ways to avoid some of these, just avoid the whole area. You don't have to buy this. And so, you know, once again, they're very small and perhaps futile, but... you know, if you can lend your support to them, I think that helps. Every tactic you can take, the multifaceted problem, every tactic you can take helps.
Thank you. Over.
I'd like to mention another effect of a boycott. When against the racist in South Africa in these times, we had a big movement of German women in the evangelical church, and they asked in the shops from where comes the fruits and the wine and so on and so on. What did they do with this question? Not only stop, they couldn't stop with this question what was going on. They couldn't stop the fruits from and the wine from South Africa. But what they did, they publicly they denied the legitimacy. And I think that's a very important question. Not only whether they can stop something, but every power needs public legitimacy. Every power needs public right. And if there's a group who denies this legitimacy, I think that's on the long run, it's a very effective thing.
Thank you.
Good.
I believe you're going to have the last word, because I'm going to cut this off promptly at 9:30.
Well, I want to speak from my own experience. My teenage daughter is now 26. Raised my consciousness in terms of a great boycott. And I really want to pick up on your idea about our children. In our churches, we have youth groups, and we're talking here about what we can do. We know that young people are consumers in this society, but we also know that our young people have moral decisions that they're making, and they too need to be into this dialogue and confronting these issues. And I have seen my own daughter come to a higher level of consciousness than I had, just because of her moving through a whole series of issues that have come to her. And it worked so that she took a semester abroad from McAllister and went to South Africa and chose to do her semester abroad paper on the women who were making and selling handicrafts in the beach areas, and how they were not unionized and how they did not have some of the protections that some of the men even in the apartheid South Africa that was at the point of changing. This was before the election of Mandela that fall. But I attribute a lot of her spiritual growth to her working herself through some of these issues. And so I think what we can do in the church is to continue this dialogue in our own churches, and not to just continue it among ourselves as adults, but also to involve our young people.
I couldn't have invented a better word than that. It's summed up a number of the themes that we've heard about the motives and purposes for actions like a boycott of Nike, that it's not simply to be hopefully effective if done in concert with other Christians here and abroad, but that it may have as well a prophetic dimension, as well a formative dimension for our young people, and that this dialogue needs to continue constantly in our local parishes. I think that we've heard a lot about the need for information and identifying groups who do research, because we can't do it all by ourselves. But I think we've heard some effective cautions against the paralysis of analysis on these fronts as well. So I think we've succeeded in complexifying this, but I think also shining through the complexity, there have been voices of hope and wisdom raised to galvanize us into conscientious, prophetic, and sometimes political action as well. I myself am going to have to rethink the choice I've made to wear Nike shoes. There are some things I don't do. I've said no to veal, for example, quietly, even though I enjoy it on the basis of what I've read. I'm not as far along as Sparky, who's a vegetarian, but I someday might be. I've said no, my wife and I did, when we bought a new home and went out to furnish it and had inherited from my grandmother a beautiful oriental carpet. But after we read how oriental carpets are woven today in some countries, it's just unbearable, the conditions of those children and them going blind with their little fingers weaving away at those things, and we found it something we couldn't do. So we've said no to some things. Others of you in here have said no to other things, and your children have, and I think somehow just getting into those practices is going to raise all of our consciousness about our own implication in this vast geopolitical juggernaut. And that in itself, it seems to me, is a good thing and essential to the Christian life. But it's obvious from what we've said tonight, we need to uphold, instruct, and join in solidarity with one another in this whole process. And I thank the panelists and thank all of you to give us at least a beginning step forward in being able to do that. So have a good evening.